All right. Welcome back to River Talk Podcast, the podcast that talks about things mostly river related and paddling related, hosted by Priscilla Macy, myself, Zach Collier, and Eric Weiseth. Eric's been out for a while working hard, but eventually I think he'll join us in again at some point and we'll get to hear his lovely voice and opinions. I know. But here we are today. We just thought we'd get out another podcast. We're going to talk about a few topics that have come across social feeds and news. One about the Clackamas fire response and a little bit of controversy there. And then we'll talk about a search and rescue incident happening on the East Coast and just kind of broadly dive into some of the challenges that it seems like search and rescue has when it comes to difficult terrain and whitewater scenarios. And we'll just spout our opinions off and I'm sure in an unfiltered way and probably be told that we're wrong, hopefully.
What I'm noticing on podcasts, Priscilla, is I've been listening to Hammer Factor and then Waterbound too. That's a great podcast.
Oh,
by those guys awesome. Back east. And I will take my dog for a walk and it's just really fun to hear people talk about boating. Mm-hmm. And I hope we're providing that same service for others. I hope that, you know, we may have wrong opinions or bad opinions and terrible audio. We might say too much or like too much.
Most of it.
I hope people appreciate this podcast as much as I appreciate having Hammer Factor and Waterbound. And hopefully people make more. I'd love to have more because it's, for me, really fun to hear people talk about boating out there.
I love it. And something that we talked about doing, we're actually going to be recording our first interview of a paddler this evening, Ben McKenzie. He will be talking about a recent trip that he did that's pretty interesting. And so our plan is to do a bit more of those interviews and just getting the voice of paddlers that are doing really cool things and have really cool stories. So those should be kind of integrated into our normally scheduled, not scheduled podcast. But we did have a listener mail from my friend Jordan Luce, a paddler rafter living in Southern Oregon still, I think. But I'll just read what he said and answer some of his questions. He says, "Hi all, I love the show and keep up the good work. I just listened to the Indigo Creek episode and loved it. I'm all in for episodes that talk about exploratory runs like that." So are we. I had a couple questions for that episode and I think it would be interesting to be discussed. Number one, the McKenzie method sounds like a great one, so two quick questions about it. First, is the drilling the ends of the crack? I never thought of this, but it's a great way to stop the crack from spreading. And do you have a method to do this in the field? Yes, and we definitely did that on the Indigo Creek trip. We were trying to find like a little screwdriver or pin in our multi-tools, and I think ultimately we just used a narrow screwdriver head and kind of hammered it in a little bit to start it and then just twisted it until it got to the point where it was clear it was going to keep the crack from
spreading. Like a little thing somebody Leatherman had this little thing that went in that I felt like was really good for that.
Yeah. And it kind of, I remember it kind of looking like a leather punch, but smaller. Yeah. And so that worked really well, but you can be creative. Obviously in the field, you got to use what you have. I've seen, or maybe it's me that tried to do it with a sharp rock one time, but get creative or carry a good multi-tool. And then the second question about that is, can you clarify what you mean by weaving the duct tape? Are you actually going over and under, or are you just having some vertical strips covered by some horizontal strips? The answer to that, it's more of a crosshatch than a weave. So you're doing some strips one way and some the other, and you're alternating in between. So it ends up being kind of like almost like a fiberglass type weave looking thing. And that's what keeps it secure. Cause if you can think of how the boat would be abraded when you're going over rocks and whatnot, is you want to make sure that it's not just in one direction or it'll rip off really easily. So number two, as a suggestion, I know many of you are skilled at these exploratory runs. So maybe an episode where you could talk about some of the skills in these exploratory situations, everything from beginning to end of planning, how to look at maps, water levels, whatnot, and then the trip itself. So throw and goes, small eddy exits, out of boats, grabbing others, etc. Yes, we definitely want to do that. And I already talked to Jacob about coming on for that podcast, and he's also excited to do that. So hopefully we can have a full crew for that podcast to talk about all our different approaches. So soon. And number three, I'm very intrigued by the idea of just being able to do the run after the confluence. This may be answered by the question above, but any thoughts on Forest Road 510? And he provided a map. And so I consulted our logistics expert, Jacob, about his thoughts on that. And he said that he took a look at it and it seemed doable, but it probably would be a challenging bushwhack, and thought that just by looking at it himself, he'd probably plan for like a half a day to do the bushwhack itself before getting down to the river, and would certainly advise bringing a chainsaw to deal with potential logs on the road, because that often seems to be an issue in that area, whether it's from windfall or fire or disease or just regular trees falling down. So that was his input. So,
and the question he's asking is, does it make sense to put at the confluence of the West Fork of Indigo Creek and the East Fork of Indigo Creek to just run the best part of the whole run? So that would be pretty ideal to put in there.
Yeah. It's worth exploring for sure.
Because and if somebody figures it out, we'd all love to know. But those roads, you look at a map and he's like, oh, there's roads. Mm-hmm. But when you get out there, that doesn't mean there's roads. So they're either grown over, partially because of fire, like all the trees that have fallen over, and they're not easy roads. Your Toyota Corolla is not going to make it.
No.
This is.
And if you get lucky, they may have changed and improved the roads. They've been doing a lot of that work in areas where there's been fire, but you kind of have to probe and test it out and probably do several trips to really figure out if this road is one of those ones that goes, if it's a 4x4 road or if it's even in commission still. Sometimes we find roads that have little information and we're like, oh, it's been dug out, and like, unless you have a UTV or an ATV, you're not going to get in there. So I'd be stoked to hear what you find if you have time to do some of the logistics digging on that access route. So thanks for the message, Jordan, and thanks for listening.
I would, in a heartbeat, I would do that run. If you could drive down that road and there's a nice trail, like if people paddled it, that would be an absolute classic.
Yeah. Oh, I would definitely go back. So that was our listener mail. I guess we can get into our topic. So as everyone knows, there's been a lot of fires throughout the West, and we are learning in some areas how well the response has gone. And then in some areas, there's been issues and I would say a bit of controversy about how the response has gone forward. There was a recent news article that was published about the Clackamas River fire, which is in Oregon near Estacada. And the article lays out that when the fire was happening, there were horses, or there were livestock, homes, and then as well as like recreation areas that were threatened and starting to burn. And it sounds like what happened is a lot of the private citizens and property owners started to respond to the fire, utilizing their own private flatbed trucks with water tanks and hoses, like you'd see on an agricultural operation, and keeping the fire at bay. And they noticed that a lot of the firefighters were just in the city strategizing about a plan of how to approach the fire. And so my reading between the lines is that it sounds like a lot of rules and bureaucracy got in the way of what the community would see as an adequate response time to the fire basically didn't happen. So all these private citizens were kind of left unhelped and had to continue doing what they were doing to try to save their homes and property and the surrounding area. Of course, this is not an example that could be applied to all the other operations going on. This is just an example that has been brought to light that the community feels like should be addressed. And I think broadly, it's interesting to think about how organized or public entities have so many protocols that sometimes it I don't know if this would be appropriate to call a heuristic trap or not, but it's one of those things that you just get stuck in the planning process. And meanwhile, the town's burning down. So I thought that might be something interesting to talk about. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think this stuff is difficult for the agencies. I mean, yeah. I think that they don't have the always the ability at a moment's notice to prepare for statewide fires everywhere and do it correctly. So, I mean, I have a little bit of empathy for the agencies. You know, they're not going to be perfect. I don't think they're going to make mistakes. They can always do better. So it's easy to say, well, you should have done this, this, and this, but they have to have bureaucracy, or there will just be people out there going crazy, doing unsafe things. Firefighters getting hurt or worse. So I think it's easy to give them the agencies a hard time. But I try to have a little empathy for the position they're at and the struggles they have managing that many people at the same time.
Yeah. And I agree. I think my comment is seeing similar things, not of this scale, of course, happening in working with agencies or employees of agencies. And at least in the United States, we operate in a world that's very, very driven to avoid liability because there are lots of lawsuits and potential for that sort of hazard for agencies to have to deal with. So then you set up these rules and these protocols to follow. But sometimes I think we fall in the trap of not always understanding why the rules are there and how to critically think about the scenario that's happening and realizing maybe we need to expedite this in a way that, of course, is safe and reasonable, but maybe we don't need. And I'm not specifically saying this example, but this is the extreme example. Maybe we don't need to have a 4-hour meeting to determine what the best approach to responding is, because this, whatever they're responding to, is time sensitive. So how do we streamline those types of lines of communication and those planning processes and those avoidances of liability and, of course, important things like avoiding putting people in danger when they shouldn't have to be, but also having the bigger picture in mind. And I think we're in a learning phase of that, especially with the scale of the wildfires that are happening and with how many players have had to become involved in responding to them, that all have their own basically leaders that have to communicate to their teams and then communicate to another layer of leadership.
Yeah, and I think that there's something to be said for the go slow to go fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just take your first initial thoughts and deploy that, that could have been completely wrong and misplaced resources. So, you know, there's the make quick decisions, solve immediate problems, and then there's the take way too long to figure things out. And there's probably a nice happy medium. But yeah. I think they need to meet and talk about the big picture. And I don't know enough. I mean, this is not my world at all, but
nor is it mine.
It's really easy to critique the agencies because it's really easy to critique the government. And no matter what they do afterwards, people will. I know in Southern Oregon right now, from an environmentalist standpoint, I'm not very happy with some of the bulldozing lines they're doing for the fires down there. I know these areas. They don't need. They're not going to burn. They've burnt already, and they're on serpentine soil. But the agencies are deciding to put bulldoze lines in to protect these areas. These areas already are barriers. And so I'm frustrated by that, but I'm trying to have some empathy because it's somebody's maybe just moved here 3 years ago, 2 years ago, 6 months ago, uh-huh. who's now a district ranger or a forest supervisor or something.
Yeah.
Making a decision for area they don't know, and very quickly, and when I say quickly, a day is quick to make these massive decisions. So it's just, they'll never get it perfect.
Yeah. Well,
there's either they're going to make some people, the landowners, unhappy, or they're going to, you know, hurt a firefighter, make the family unhappy, or the environmentalists are going to be unhappy. they're juggling so many different things, they're going to get criticized from some side. I think they're doing the best they can.
Yeah.
But I'm not on the field, so I have no idea.
I think the example that I think of in this scenario, which, you know, is something both of us do know pretty well, is river rescue, and thinking about those examples where you've had, I guess the easy example is someone that's taken a lot of rescue courses, but not necessarily done it in the field yet. And mm-hmm. so you can think about how their mind operates as like, oh, I've been told all these rules and I have to go through all those rules before I respond. Meanwhile, there's someone floating down the river and they didn't think to just throw rope. And, you know, I see this on the Lower Rogue, or have seen this on the Lower Rogue all the time. Folks running the fish ladder, getting stuck, like setting up a Z drag and blocking traffic forever because that's what they've been taught to do. And that's the protocol that they know. Meanwhile, you have someone that's done it, you know, 100 times and they just throw a rope to the boat and pull them off the rock. And
they just jump off the boat and push.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, I guess this is where the heuristic part of it comes in, is we're taught these protocols and rules for a reason. So it establishes a way for us to streamline the process when there's a crisis, is we're having people who are experts thinking about all those things, but they're able to recognize, oh, just throw rope because the guy's going downstream. We don't need to have a committee meeting to determine what to do.
but I think the case in this case, this is where experience matters a lot. So on the river, it's really nice to have experienced boaters who just know, like, guys, come on, don't pull those ropes out. This is easy. I'll take care of this. And I think it's probably the case with our government agencies. If you have employees that have been there for 20, 30 years, career employees, who've seen things go wrong, great. But if it's all new people, there's going to be problems just based mm-hmm. on experience. And so I think that for my mind, I wish that they better funded the Forest Service. That's just like what comes to mind. The Forest Service budget just keeps getting cut year after year after year. And people's tenures at particular districts are now very short.
Well, so Great American Outdoors Act fixed that.
Hopefully.
they're doing quite well, at least in Oregon. They are very happy with some of the revenue sources they've been getting. So I'm hoping that a lot of that changes. But you're exactly right. The turnover and the short tenure of folks in those positions has been a problem, not just only in response type scenarios, but in planning. Is, you know, you're working with someone for 6 months and you get to a point where you're making progress and then they go through another hiring process and then you're redoing that over and over again. And so I think what you're saying is, if you're applying that to like emergency response, of course it's going to have issues. Is if you don't have those immediate experts that are able to break past the protocols and the rules and in onboarding and make quick decisions, then that becomes a problem.
I mean, you want the 20, 30 year veterans there, but also people who know that land.
Right.
And I don't mean to just use the Forest Service, but in all the agencies, in some of them, an employee might have gone from Minnesota and just moved here 3 weeks ago for this job. And now they're responsible for making decisions that save a particular forest,
mm-hmm.
right? That's rough. And so that's not ideal. And so it may just be they're doing the best they can, but unfortunately it's a new person who doesn't know enough about the area or the job to do it at the highest level. So encouraging people to stay in these positions for long periods of time and developing experience, I think would be helpful.
Yeah. I also think something that, I'm certain all these people are thinking about this now and maybe have already started doing it, is it seems like more and more firefighters are not only going to have to be trained in their specialty. So if you're a city fire department, you're going to focus your training on structure, medical emergencies, more urban type of environments. But as we have more cases like what we're experiencing now, where there's wildfires that are also coming into inhabited areas, you're going to need folks that are not only trained and proficient in wildfire fighting, but also have an understanding of structural emergency response, which, you know, not all wildland firefighters are trained in that. And then not all firefighters that are most often dealing in an urban setting are.
They're totally different things. They're so completely different things.
That could be part of the issue, is you just have people that are trained for one thing, and this is a completely new field, you know? Yeah. So
I feel uncomfortable going too in depth onto this, because I just, this is not my area of expertise at all. And I could be saying things that are completely wrong.
Oh yeah, I agree.
But I just wanted to say, I do have empathy for the people who are here. This is their job to protect us, because they're a lot of times in a tough spot.
Yeah. And I also have, I understand frustration
from
community members that are watching, you know, their entire life burn up and feel helpless and feel like they should have some support. So it's a very difficult issue, but we obviously, all of us very much appreciate the hard work that the firefighters and emergency responders have been doing in this time. And it's been tough for everyone. So, well, that was just the interesting news that I saw someone sent me, and I was like, oh, that would be something interesting to talk about. Not that there's any great answer, but certainly something interesting to discuss. What do you have, Zach? What do you want to talk about?
I don't really have any big news. You know, my season just ended. We had to cancel our last three trips on the Rogue because of smoke. So our summer season's over. So I have free time again. It feels great.
So more gear garages.
More gear garages, more walking the dog. I've even gone paddling a few times.
Nice.
Just life slowing down. This summer was rough. And I'm excited to talk to Eric sometime about how COVID went. I barely talked to him this summer, even about anything. But, you know, the whole industry had to change how we do things to get through the season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of us figured out how to do responsibly, get through COVID. And I'm really fascinated to look back at it and maybe talk to Eric more on a podcast about what did we do, what worked, what didn't work, you know. But it was for me the most difficult summer I've been through as an outfitter, or tied for maybe the second most difficult, but either way, it was tough. And to be done feels really good. And I'm looking forward to going boating. Like definitely, our trips to Bhutan are canceled. So I'm looking forward to just being here for the next few months and paddling.
Yeah, me too. I guess something else to talk about related to fire is how different the paddling season is going to look this upcoming, but how different the paddling opportunities are going to be, if even available, in a lot of regions in the state. Like, for example, the Little North Fork Sannie Am is entirely burned. So there's a number of creeks, and then, you know, Opal Creek, the section that people call Opal Creek that's paddled, the upper part of the Little North Sannie Am, and then the regular part of the Little North Sannie Am, and then parts of the regular North Sannie Am, like, most likely will not be accessible for some time, in the same way that we saw Eagle Creek need time for just the natural process of it restoring itself, as well as rebuilding trails and roads and access points. And we went through this process at American Whitewater of trying to, as best as we could with the information out there, identify all of the runs that were going to be impacted. And I have to tell you, the list in Oregon was pretty darn disheartening.
Isn't it my take, and I know nothing about this, Priscilla, so I'm curious these places, but isn't it mostly stuff near where you live?
Well, so there, yeah, I would say that, you know,
because there's nothing in the gorge where I live. There's nothing where I live affected by fires.
Well, the White River was affected.
Okay.
Kind of near.
I mean, I don't paddle that maybe once every 4 years.
Yeah. So the White
and
River,
Southern Oregon, it's just so Southern Oregon, pretty much unaffected.
Yeah. Right? I want to say yes, because when I'm remembering what we were all writing down, there was only a section of the rogue that was affected, and it was the kind of mellow day floater tuber stretch.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if any of the upper forks of the road were affected access wise. Last I checked, I don't remember that they were, but I'll pull up the list just to make sure I'm not making up things.
But to me, this feels like the Salem to Eugene paddling, everything to the to the east, which is a lot of paddling.
A lot. I mean, the Willamette Valley and some of the stuff in the Cascades area got absolutely crushed. And so like the Brighton Bush, Little North Fork, Santee Am, and then associated tributaries, the McKenzie River. I'm not sure if the Blue River was affected. Last I checked, the section that's paddled was not, but potentially access could be impacted by the surrounding fire. And of course, the fires are not done yet. So depending on how much they're contained and where their direction goes, there could be more things that are impacted. So the Willamette Valley will certainly be interesting. And another note on that, I know there's a lot of community enthusiasm and trying to figure out what we can do to help restore these areas. And there has been a number of efforts led by local watershed groups and nonprofits and community members and paddlers to organize some work around that once it's safe to do so in a formal way. And so if you're interested in that, I'd just recommend reaching out to your local watershed council or researching a bit about the area for who's doing that work and volunteering in that way, if you don't already have other methods to do so. Yeah.
What's a watershed council?
So watershed councils are often nonprofit groups that use community members and other organizations to do various things. So a lot of them are often focused on water quality, restoring like riparian areas, improving fish habitat. But it just kind of depends on the scope of their work based on the membership of their group and what watershed they're working on. So for example, the Long Tom Watershed Council is very much focused on improving water quality in that area because that's a big issue for them. And so a watershed council that would be located in an area where a lot of recreation happens would probably be more focused on recreation opportunities and balancing that with conservation and environmental type of work.
Well, I haven't at all taken in the breadth of what's happened here. I haven't spent time in that area where you're at. So I have no concept of how bad it is, but it sounds bad.
It's pretty sobering. We drove up the Santee Am Canyon to help a friend do some preparation for rain at a property that had burned down that was on the river. And just driving through the area, it was the town, like a lot of the town structures had burnt down. There's melted hotel signs, you know, tons of homes had burned down. And then just the river, it was so odd to see this landscape that's every memory of I have of it is just, oh, it's Oregon, you know, it's mossy and green and beautiful and clear streams. And it was just charred and smoky and black. And you could see the bedrock and boulders underneath the what would normally be the forest canopy that you would never see these rocks or landscape features had it not burned. So it's just is an entirely different landscape. I do have to say what was really, really cool and a little bit heartwarming to see when we were there is as we were doing this restoration work and laying down hay bales and these things called wattles, which is a bunch of sawdust in a long roll, like a long sausage roll that you dig a ditch, you put it in the ground so that it helps make sure the soil doesn't just kind of slough off when the rains come. So we're doing all that. And then we look down at the river and we see these huge salmon spawning amidst all of this chaos, burning forest. The salmon are just like,
wow,
doing their thing. And that was just really cool to see. But yeah, lots of work ahead to do. And we're all still very much in it. And the fires are not done yet. So we're all just, you know, asking the folks that we know that are affected how to help, and trying to support in the small ways that we can.
Yeah, and that reminds me that Sawyer Oars and Paddles, they're in, based in Talent, the warehouse in Talent.
Yeah.
And they were spared. I mean, the fires came near their warehouse, but they were spared, and they've started a relief fund for the people of Talent. And in that account, those communities, Talent and Phoenix, there's a lot of boaters there.
I mean, they're
kind of boating communities in a way.
It's a hub.
It's a hub. It's not a traditional hub, but it's a hub. And so I will put a link into, there's a GoFundMe if anyone wants to donate $5 to $10,000 to help the people rebuild. You know, Sawyer's taking a lead and they're matching a lot of the money. So I will throw a link up on the website if anybody wants to help out with that.
Yeah. And also do a shout out to Sam Drevo and Energy Kayaking. There's also a related effort to help support some of the rebuilding in the San Yam Canyon. He did also lose one of his business properties, but fortunately another one of them was fine, but there will certainly be more efforts to try to get them up and running as well. And I know there might also be guides and outfitters and paddlers affected in the Clackamas fires as well. So if we become aware of any efforts to help in that area, we'll post them as well.
Do you know what happened? Have you heard about the Clackamas River? Did that whole area burn down, or it's just, I've been told the fire was exactly at where the upper Clackamas is.
It is. Yeah. So areas like, Fish Creek, the Kalawash River, like Blister Creek Falls, upper Clackamas, boating, that whole area is very much affected in the fire, and the Riverside fire is still going on and they're still fighting that.
I mean, that area is a mecca for Portland boaters. Mm-hmm. And boaters around Oregon, it's just like one of the most amazing places that people learn on and go every weekend. It's an amazing resource, I hope. If the even fire went through, hopefully those old growth Douglas firs withstood some of the high temperatures.
I'm hoping the same thing for the Opal Creek Wilderness. Is this just such a magical place? And there's,
I'm not ready to accept that. I don't want to wrap my head around that one.
I know. I'm just hoping all those old growth Doug firs and cedars had enough thick bark, and some of it will have made it out.
Yeah. Well, do you want to move on? This is starting to depress me.
I know. I'm getting sad. it is all very sad and awful. I don't know. I don't really have much more on the agenda.
Well, do you want to talk about this rescue effort in West Virginia?
Sure. Yeah. So there was a rescue that happened in West Virginia, and Hammer Factor did a podcast interviewing folks involved in that. And I believe they interviewed the paddler who required rescue. So I recommend listening to that for all of the details. But what was interesting and not unique, because I've read about similar scenarios and been involved in similar scenarios, is that what happened is paddlers knew something was wrong, called the relevant search and rescue individuals. They were unable to locate the individual, kind of called off or let off on the search because it had become night. And so some paddlers rallied and ended up executing the rescue in a pretty short manner of time and got the guy extracted to a point where search and rescue was waiting and could provide medical attention if needed. But this is not a unique example in that in a lot of areas, search and rescue is really not equipped to deal with whitewater scenarios, especially in remote areas with steep terrain. And so it seems like there is an increasing need to partner with expert paddlers, paddlers that are aware of, experienced and trained in rescue to be able to get to these people in time, because it, you know, it so often seems to happen where you run out of daylight and it's on this river that you can't expect just the standard search and rescue person to be able to navigate whitewater rapids and then to be able to respond to someone and get them out of a canyon. So this is a conversation I've been having for a couple of years with the Oregon Sheriff's Association and how we can improve that. One way is you can, in Oregon, it's different in every state, but in Oregon, you can form a group and get it vetted by your county. And then they become, they receive some training from the sheriffs and then are basically vetted as a search and rescue group. So in Corvallis, we have the Corvallis Mountain Search and Rescue. There's various other climbing and mountain specific rescue groups. There's actually a equestrian search and rescue group and a snowmobiling ATV.
Wait. They rescue horses or rescue people on horses?
They rescue people on horses. Like if horses are the best way to get to them.
They use horses to rescue people.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't go out and find horses that are lost.
No, that would be awesome. I want to do that. No, they use skilled equestrians to access people with horses. And so these types of groups have been vetted through the relevant sheriff's office, because that's our search and rescue hub in Oregon. And then, so when there's a scenario where the sheriffs realize they are the group that has the skill set to help them, they call them. They're basically on a call list. So what would be needed in Oregon is to have relevant regional groups of paddlers with the appropriate skill set to go forth and creating their own groups to be able to be on a call list. So if someone's stuck on the Chetco, you would have a group or a party that the sheriffs have recognized that would be able to call on their skill set, versus just having, which is always a problem with search and rescue and professionals in trying to keep external parties safe, is it doesn't often work out for paddlers just to show up and offer help. Because there's some concern with the sheriffs taking on the liability of sending more people into a potentially dangerous scenario.
I think in that case, I think about this a lot. The rescue personnel, this is their job. This is their world. And they can't vet whether people showing up are useful or not.
True.
And so I bet enough times people that are dummies show up and they go, oh, I know how to throw a throw bag. And they go in and make the situation worse. And I think rule number one is don't make the situation worse.
Yeah.
And so I think that a lot of times, because the sheriffs, the rescue, they can't vet people on the spot, it's hard for them to work with other people who could, things can spiral out of control fast.
And that's exactly it. And that's exactly what they have told me is like, well, it would be great if we could trust everyone. And there probably was a time where people were trustworthy and capable, but it's happened enough times where it's fired back. And at least in Oregon, the sheriffs have to take that liability because search and rescue is their prerogative. And I think that's completely fair. I'm thinking if I was in that role, I wouldn't want to just trust I think in one of my rescue classes, we called them Bermuda Joes, like the dude showing up in a Hawaiian shirt and shorts and flip-flops and is like ready to go rescue someone. But I think it's also important that there is more of a collaboration and communication lines established with the whitewater boating community and search and rescue parties to help educate them on what our skill sets are, what we can offer. And to, you know, like you said, search and rescue is their world, but whitewater rivers are not their world.
I mean, I hear you 100%. In the ideal world, this is sort of like the first discussion we had. It was like, oh, wouldn't it be better if the agencies did better? right? This is sort of like, wouldn't it be better if somebody went and volunteered their time to develop whitewater rescue groups all over Oregon? That would be better, but we don't have, who's going to do that?
Yeah, that's the question. It's like when I'm sitting in a room with the sheriffs, they're like, if you want to start this, I'm like, well, I would love to start this, but I can think of a number of folks that, you know, teach whitewater rescue, are competent paddlers and very involved in the communities where they already have relationships with sheriffs and law enforcement.
So I think that would be big. Like, I feel like when you're a search water instructor in an area, you do have that relationship. Mm-hmm. And so hopefully the sheriffs know to call that instructor who can then go in and solve that problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And
help,
even
or help or assist.
Just assist a personal relationship counseling. Too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, I have some relationships with the sheriffs here. And once I got that, it was kind of funny. It's terrible that this happened. There was an incident where someone fell off of a waterfall and I got a text from one of the guys. He's like, hey, here's a scenario. I'll let you know if any help is needed. And like, I'm not a formal group or anything. I just have a relationship with these people and I've explained my skill set and we have rapport. And so I think if you know folks that work in that realm or have some sort of relationship with law enforcement or search and rescue, I think continuing to bolster trusting relationships and lines of communication with those folks goes a long way. And then you create a community where now in Oregon, search and rescue has a pretty good idea of like climbing and vertical extraction and who to call and who to consult. And we just don't necessarily have that in Oregon for whitewater yet. But I think there's a lot of opportunity
Who would do that? Would that be like the Oregon Whitewater Association?
It might be, or it might be the ACA. The ACA is one that I think of that has so many strong relationships with various agencies and partners, and then also facilitates lots of rescue classes. So I think, you know, in the ideal scenario, it would be an organization like that that has those relationships, but then has a network of regional folks like, say, Sam Drevo or, you know, Bart Baldwin down south who runs search and rescue programs or training programs. And so then you have that network that's facilitated by kind of a larger organization that has full-time staff to then integrate with law enforcement and search and rescue. But
right, let's go back to this.
Other ways to do it.
Let's go back to this rescue thing in West Virginia, I think, because so I read it. I didn't read it very carefully. I kind of just skimmed it. And so somebody went kayaking by themselves, got stuck behind a waterfall. And some people basically figured out, tell me if I'm wrong here, that because his car was in the parking lot and he didn't answer his phone, that he was still on the river. And they deduced he was behind this waterfall. They went out to look. It turns out he was behind the waterfall. They did some things to start rescuing him. This was eight hours later. It got dark. Rescue personnel showed up. They interacted with the rescue personnel and eventually got this guy out from behind the waterfall. Is that the quick story?
I think that's a high-level summary. I also didn't have time to read through all the details. And I think there was a post that had
we didn't do the homework.
Comments. No, and that's why I say listen to the Hammer Factor, because they talk to the people who actually were on the ground doing this. But
I'm going to listen to it when I walk my dog tonight.
Yeah,
I'm curious. But I think for me, and so it sounds like there was interaction between the kayakers and the rescuers that was positive.
Yeah, I don't think anything was negative other than the fact that they felt like the rescue response, the abilities of the rescue individuals weren't really suitable to help.
Oh, of course. There's no way.
And that's kind of the thing, is they don't have that skill set. So then the paddlers kind of had to take it in their own hands, which of course, depending, and I don't know what the laws are in West Virginia, maybe it's a little less.
Probably a little looser in West Virginia, I'm guessing. Yeah, I bet it's a little looser.
So maybe it wasn't an issue for them to just kind of take it in their own hands and then have the search and rescue at the end to help provide any sort of medical attention. But without knowing any details and totally hypothesizing, I'm just imagining a scenario where, say, I guess this has happened before with myself and Jacob and others, is you get to a scene and then you call 911, you say, all right, we need help. This is the scenario. Search and rescue shows up and you've already been working on it. You know that you have the skill set to assist. And then you are said, you can't do this. And to the extent where you could possibly be arrested for doing that.
I mean, this is the same story as Die Hard, right? John McClane is in the Nakatomi Tower.
Yep, totally.
And the FBI shows up and they're like, we got this. And John McClane does his own thing and saves the day.
Totally.
Right. And so you need to decide if you're going to be John McClane.
I like that. But don't be the guy that goes in, or girl, or whoever that goes in and just decides to save the day, and you end up being Bermuda Joe that needs someone to rescue you.
And that's why this is so tough. There's not an exact answer for it. Like, John McClane knows he can be John McClane, but not everybody thinks they're John McClane, but they're not. And so I think we need to, as boaters, be respectful of our local agencies and recognize that's their jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And then try to go say, hey, just so you guys know, I'm an experienced paddler. I'm a certified search water rescue technician. I'm here to help you guys. Please use me as an asset. Mm-hmm. Knowing that the ideal thing may not happen. The exact thing may not happen, but there is a bureaucracy that happens that kind of needs to happen for the overall best common good. And I would say for every time, this would be my guess, every time somebody shows up to help a search and rescue team and the search and rescue team says no, and that was a mistake, there's probably two times they said no and it wasn't a mistake. So I would say the net positive of the bureaucracy is probably good, but there will always be examples out there where it's like, oh, search and rescue didn't let us help. We could have saved his life when he died. Mm-hmm. Right. But you probably saved 2 or 3 or 10 other lives by following the protocol. I don't know. That's just my guess.
Well, but yeah,
I'm a rule follower.
I think part of it is true.
Rules for a reason.
I think the rules were obviously created for a reason. And when you're thinking about a public entity that is serving the general populace, that's generally nincompoops, you have to create rules to protect the nincompoops and the others that they might affect by just making executive decisions. What I have noticed with search and rescue people that seems like they have a pretty good big picture understanding of everything is when they're on a scene and they know they can't say, you have the green light for me to do whatever you're going to do. They'll say, you understand if you do this, I'm not authorizing it. If you end up doing something wrong, you're going to make our resources even more limited and potentially cause, you know, harm to the person needing to be rescued. And so then you're putting, creating the onus on them. And I feel like in that scenario, they might be saying that to be like, you know, do it, but I'm not saying do it sort of thing. And so they're in ways mitigating their responsibility, but not necessarily, you know, it's like, I'm going to go turn around and check my car and you do what you have to do sort of thing. And I won't know about it.
That's the John McClane way. I like
totally,
the John McClane
totally.
Way.
Yeah. So it's a balance. It's a balance. Yeah. And there's a lot of learning.
If you go John McClane, you may not save the day. You might get hurt or die. And your wife's not going to take you back in the end. Like, it's not going to be the happy ending John McClane had.
Yeah, totally. So, but I think the overall message that I feel like is important, and this ties back to the firefighting we are talking about, is there's a learning curve. And I think that the learning curve is helped by our community being more engaged and creating good lines of communication and trust with the people that are involved in these sorts of responses. And then through that, maybe there's policy changes or protocol changes that reflect learning within those organizations about specific rescue scenarios. And so, I think it all comes down to
Your takeaway is we should maybe work more closely with our local search and rescue to be experts, to be expert consultants they can call when they need us.
Exactly. I think that's one of the most effective, I would say, grassroots ways to become more involved. And that's what a lot of other recreation groups have done. And there's lots of good models of it in other states where, like Colorado and Montana, have very specialized volunteer or private rescue groups that often work with search and rescue when it comes to climbing or snowmobiling or very specific activities that you wouldn't ever expect search and rescue general professionals to be equipped to deal with. So it's basically you're having consultants to deal with very, very specific scenarios.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. I think it's brilliant. It takes us as paddlers on our part to get the training and then to present ourselves to local officials as people to call. I think it's absolutely on us to say, hey, we're the heroes. We're not Bermuda Joes. We're safety squirrels. Call us when you need our help. And if you need us to go through some weekend of training with you guys, we're willing to put that time in.
Absolutely.
Let me tell you my takeaway.
Do it.
Don't paddle solo. I read this on Facebook and it started with it being a solo paddler. If he had friends he was paddling with, this wouldn't have been a problem.
Yeah, I think that is part of it. I've said my stance on solo paddling.
I know, I hear you. But we've been through this before. I just think when I read this article, by paddling by yourself, he put himself in jeopardy. And then by putting himself in jeopardy, he put others in jeopardy.
Here's my devil's advocate response. I think the same could be said for doing anything by yourself. Like if you're driving on a road without cell service and your car breaks down and if you had another person, sure.
This is the same argument as creature crafters saying, it's okay if I creature craft sunset falls. I could die driving too. Right?
I don't think that's the same.
So I think paddling, to me, it's a cardinal rule. Don't paddle alone. So that's just to me. And I get the people paddle solo, but I think if you look at the American Whitewater Accident Database, a lot of the fatalities are people paddling alone. And so I think if our goal is to be safer, you'll never be safe, but be responsible, we shouldn't paddle solo. And if we do paddle solo, we have to understand the added risk associated with that. Yeah. And I feel like this story is a sobering reminder of that.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree. I need to listen to the Hammer Factor episode too.
Well, now I'm going to listen to it and hopefully I don't feel like an idiot.
Me too.
Because they may just have said something completely different and I'll be like, oh man, I'm totally a moron. They had really good points to make. My point was terrible. So we'll go.
That's why we podcast.
but also like these discussions are good. Like we're both like I'm learning this idea of like I've never thought about going to my agency in town and saying, hey, I have some training. If there's ever a problem, I'm happy to help. Like I think that's great.
Yeah. And in my experience, all of those conversations just are so positive. And I feel like I learn a lot more about frustrations I have and have certainly changed my mind about a lot of them and have gained a lot of respect for the things that these folks are required to do and have to do and a lot of the challenges mm-hmm. that they have to face. So it's always great to learn more and increase your knowledge. And if you're in a position where you can reach out to your local search and rescue individuals and create a relationship, that's all the better for the broader community.
I'm going to put out my to-do list now.
Woohoo. Awesome.
I never thought of it.
Well, in your area, it's Sheriff. I work with him. He's awesome. I don't know why I'm blanking on his name, but your Hood River Sheriff is super awesome and he's great. And he's helped with a lot of outdoor recreation stuff. So I think it'll be a good conversation.
Yeah. Let's wrap this up.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had some gear of the week.
Titanium sporks. I was always so against titanium. Sporks to me seem like a terrible idea. It's not a spork. It's not a fork. It's not a spoon. It's the worst of both. But I've been using sporks lately, and they're actually pretty useful.
Does yours have a knife side? I really like the ones. Those ones are cool.
A titanium. Well, a spork for knife.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not that far, but Snow Peak makes one that's titanium. They're anodized, so they have colors. I don't know. I think they're cool. I'm a fan. I actually just ordered a few more right before the podcast started. You can't have enough titanium sporks in your life.
Well, now you got to just brand them with River Talk.
River Talk titanium sporks.
We'll start selling them. We'll have a marketplace on our podcast. Awesome. Sheriff Matt Taylor. Sorry. I remembered his name. Well, I don't have a gear of the week. I haven't really been doing anything lately other than working and staying inside and trying to filter smoky air. But I have a reading recommendation. So it's called The Adventure Gap by James Edward Mills. And it kind of does two things. It chronicles the first all African-American summit attempt on Denali, the highest point in North America. And then the part of the story that I really like even more is it's tying in history and the importance of inspiring future diverse generations to care about nature and to care about conservation and just how important it is that we have, a diverse array of people that really care about these places and are able to enjoy them in the same way that mostly white people have been doing forever, at least in the United States. So The Adventure Gap, great book, buy it on Amazon or wherever. Unfortunately, I haven't found an audiobook version of it, but it's well worth reading.
I'm looking at it on Amazon right now. There's a Kindle version, but I don't think there's an audiobook.
Yeah.
I'll put a link on the website.
Cool. Well, I think that's all I have.
All right. Do you want to do the awkward ending or should I do it?
I think it's your turn.
All right. I guess we'll see you later, huh? Gonna float me into a new state.